Involvement with the criminal justice system is life-changing. It matters.
Having a justice system that works is a really important part of a democratic society.
I'm Penelope Gibbs, Director of Transform Justice.
I'm Rob Allen. I've worked in and around criminal justice all my career.
This is the Transform Justice podcast, throwing light on the criminal justice system.
Hearing from people who know.
It's about whether the system's fair.
And what can be done to make it better.
Hello. Today we're tackling a huge issue. How and why neurodivergent people get into trouble with the law. By neurodivergence, we include autism, ADHD, brain injury, and learning difficulties. Here to discuss this issue are my co-host Rob Allen, Sir Robert Buckland, former Lord Chancellor, and Angela Kirwan, author of Criminal, How Our Prisons Are Failing Us All. Rob, this issue, neurodivergence, is this something that you'd come across in your work over the years?
Well, some years ago, I chaired a group of organisations called Transition to Adulthood. They commissioned some research that found that 60% of young people in custody had some kind of brain injury. And I was shocked by it. We all were. And so I'm really pleased that this issue is finally getting the attention it deserves.
Robert, the charity User Voice recently interviewed neurodivergent people who'd got into trouble with the law. And one thing the interviewees said was that they'd been called stupid, bad, or naughty as children and then kind of lived up to the label. Did that strike a chord for you?
Very, very much so indeed. And from my own professional experience as a barrister defending and prosecuting in Wales for many years, I used to represent a lot of people who would fall into that category, who'd fallen out of school quite literally because of that labelling, and who, surprise, surprise, ended up in the criminal justice system. Whilst I do believe in individual choice and agency, it is no coincidence that a large preponderance of people with some form of brain condition end up in the criminal justice system. And, you know, knowing that bare statistic means that we've got to do something about it.
And Angela, you yourself have only recently been diagnosed with ADHD. Has that diagnosis made a significant difference to your life?
Absolutely. It has been life-changing for me to have a diagnosis myself. And just knowing that explains so much of my own brain to me has helped me manage my emotions better. And since that diagnosis myself, I've realised a lot of the symptoms I experience are incredibly similar to what I saw with the men I was working with when I worked in prison. And it's really made me look back at my time working in prison through this lens of neurodiversity, neuroinclusion now, and realised lots of the behaviours we said were difficult or bad or naughty were actually very symptomatic of this condition that I also have.
So, Angela, you worked for many years as a social care worker, I think, in prisons. Looking back now, do you think some of the people who were perhaps most difficult to deal with were in fact suffering from this undiagnosed neurodivergent condition?
Absolutely. Lots of the things that lead people into prison, as Robert's alluded to, this idea of exclusion from school, risk-taking behaviours, puts people onto this path. And then once they're in prison, the difficulty managing your emotions can then lead to even more and more problems in prison, such as self-injury, fighting, using drugs illicitly. I think there is this real link between that and, specifically for me, ADHD, that's the one I understand. But if I look more widely, autism, dyspraxia, it really does now start to look like these are things that make the prison experience even more difficult for people.
Any particular examples of individuals that you can remember?
Yeah, so I worked with a gentleman, I call him in the book Kai. He was 19. He had been in and out of secure settings since the age of 12 years old. And he came into our prison and he was a very high level of risk to other people. And over time, I started working with him in the only way I could, which was through doing exercise with him. So he'd do press-ups in his cell, I'd do press-ups outside the cell door. We started to engage by trying to burn off some energy. And Kai started to do really well. We had a contract that if he ever felt that he was going to be violent, he wouldn't come out of his cell that day. And he stuck to that. He stuck to that really well. Until one day, a very nice officer who had really supported him escorted him back to his cell. And as he went to put him into his cell and close the door, he slightly touched him on his back. And as he touched Kai, Kai completely flipped out. He started punching everyone, broke an officer's nose. And when I asked him afterwards, "You promised me you would tell me if you were going to be aggressive on the landings," Kai's response was, "I wasn't on the landing, I was in my cell when he touched me." And it was only then that I thought, maybe this is something that looks a little bit like autism, that looks like ADHD, that looks like neurodivergence. He was so literal in his agreement with me, and he was so intimidated by someone gently touching him that his response was just chaotic violence. And when I worked in prison, I don't think I made a single referral for someone to have an assessment for a neurodivergent condition. It just wasn't talked about. And this is a prime example of, had I worked with Kai now, today, knowing what I know, I would have definitely asked for those kind of referrals to go in.
Mm. Robert, when you were Secretary of State in the Justice Ministry, you commissioned a review of how neurodiversity is dealt with by the police, the courts, probation, prisons. Why did you do that?
Well, because from my own lived experience as a barrister representing a number of people who were in the system who then got the diagnosis way down the line, and from my own family experience of autism, I felt that I had this privilege of being in high office and it was a great time for me to do something. And, you know, I'm proud of what we did because it is now yielding fruit. And part of the work that has produced the excellent user voice report has been coordinated by the neurodiversity coordinators who are now in most of our prisons that we wouldn't have had we not gone with the initiative on neurodiversity back in 2020. So it was an important moment for all of us, but I'm sure, as we will discuss, there's still a hell of a lot to do despite the pockets of good practice that we do see in some of our prisons.
Just to add, the big thing here is just getting the data, is asking the questions to try and find out who in prison is neurodivergent, who is even in our prison, to then start designing services. And I think that's what Robert's work did so well, that wasn't being done at the time when I worked in prison, so it just wasn't even on our radar.
And on that subject, Robert, little can be done about neurodiversity without actually the criminal justice system identifying neurodivergent people right at the beginning of the process.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a bit of a challenge, isn't it?
Well, it is. I'm a strong advocate of screening, but even screening at the prison gate is very late in the game. I really pushed when I was in office to bring back the strength of pre-sentence reports. You know, I know that there was an understandable drive to get justice delivered quickly, but I felt that in too many cases, the pre-sentence report, which is prepared by the probation service to help the court decide what the outcome should be in terms of sentence for a defendant, was falling by the wayside in a way that worried me. So I made sure that we invested more in that process. And we have seen, I think, a revival, because that's an opportunity as well for a trained officer to identify a potential clinical issue and then for diligent defence lawyers to get something commissioned from a clinician that can then offer a diagnosis in many cases. Now, that's, I think, an opportunity that we shouldn't miss.
Mm. Can I take just a step back, Angela, and ask you, I mean, in this user voice survey, quite a lot of people said that part of their neurodivergent condition is that they're susceptible to peer pressure or manipulation, and that had contributed to them getting into trouble in the first place and into the criminal justice system. To what extent do you think neurodivergent people do get into trouble, in part at least, because of the condition that they have?
I think the kind of broad spectrum of neurodivergence means that the way people's brains work is just incredibly individual and incredibly different depending on which condition you have and your upbringing and your socialization anyway. So I think it's hard to make generalizations. My kind of brain would do things because I really want to impress people and I want some dopamine to try and feel the normal level of dopamine a neurotypical person would. And I'm definitely not an expert on all the different neurodivergent conditions. But anecdotally, I would definitely say that trying to be part of a group and trying to impress people and feeling a bit of peer pressure, I think, is definitely relevant to all neurodivergent conditions.
Mm. Hey, Robert, what do you think? I mean, a lot of people in prison are estimated to have these neurodivergent conditions of one sort or another. Is that because people are particularly likely to commit serious crime, or because the system tends to perhaps over-criminalize some of those who are neurodivergent, or a bit of both?
I think it's a bit of both. I think it's more the former than the latter. I think that we shouldn't forget that in no way should autism or neurodiversity be used as an excuse. It might be a factor that leads to criminality, but it can only ever, I think, or in most cases, be a mitigating factor, unless the crime is very much related to a misreading of the situation and a genuine lack of criminal intent. But I think fundamentally it's the former. We need to make this a non-criminal justice issue in the first place. And that's why when I sat around the cabinet table, I used to tell all my colleagues, you're all criminal justice departments, because you've all got responsibility to help upstream prevent what then becomes a downstream criminal justice problem. And that's, of course, in particular in education, we've talked about school exclusions, and in health fundamentally, and those early years where conditions like autism and ADHD can be identified.
I mean, Robert, looking at different crimes, there's one crime in particular where I think that there can be an issue of understanding where, say, autistic people are coming from, which is one of them is stalking. And the father of somebody who'd been arrested for stalking who was autistic said to me, you know, one of the problems is that my son, my adult son, he really doesn't understand the harm he's doing by messaging such and such a person. Have you heard that about stalking cases?
I have. And I think that what we need to understand is, of course, in stalking, there is a requirement for intent, sometimes intent to cause fear of violence. And I think that where there is a genuine issue of intent, then I think identification of the condition to see whether that relates to the issue in question. Won't always. I mean, again, I think it's important, and it's important for autistic people themselves and neurodiverse people themselves, that we don't, you know, assume that that is a blanket excuse or a blanket reason. Of course, they're capable of committing criminal offences, you know, just like the rest of the population. But that it is then properly understood if the matter goes to trial. And I still worry that ultimately, I think a lot of people feel that if they flag their neurodiverse issue, that somehow they won't be believed and that they're less capable of reliability and belief. And that in itself is related to very low self-esteem issues that will accompany neurodiverse behaviour. The self-esteem of some of these, particularly young men, is on the floor. And until you deal with that, you're not going to be able to reach them in terms of helping find a better way to respond to situations and to make those judgments that are often very poorly executed because, frankly, the adrenaline is just raging through their bodies, through their heads, and they're just in fight or flight mode. And it's that level of understanding that we now need to get to, I think.
Yeah. I mean, when people are convicted, there is a sentencing guideline that says that their culpability, their blameworthiness may be reduced if they were suffering from an impairment or a disorder at the time of the offence. Do you think that's a good way of framing it? And do you think courts do take enough account of that factor when sentencing?
Well, I think it is a very useful factor to have at hand. Culpability is one of the fundamental planks of assessing the seriousness of an offence. It becomes before any mitigating factors. There are two things the court has to consider. It's the harm caused to the victim and the culpability, the blameworthiness of the defendant. And then, once that is established, they then look to aggravating factors that make it worse or mitigating factors that make it better. So if we can address at the early stage what the true level of culpability was, I think it could go a long way to help inform the courts and to impose sentences that are frankly more appropriate and more condign. I think there are plenty of good examples out there, really diligent criminal lawyers who are doing their job, but I wonder whether, in fact, court itself should be asking even more questions and trying to initiate and getting counsel and solicitors to think about these issues from the get-go.
And the get-go is obviously the police custody, where a decision can be made not to send to court in the public interest anyway. So we're talking about court, but, you know, for lower level offences, if the intent doesn't really seem to be there, there's huge opportunities there too, aren't there?
Well, I agree. All of us want to see justice being done. And let's not forget that, you know, we have victims of crime. We have an obligation to them to make sure that the system delivers justice. But at the same time, we also have safeguards in place in order for the accused and their representatives to make appropriate representations that either relate to the weight of the evidence or indeed whether or not it's in the public interest. And I think sometimes it's that second limb that we should be looking at more in working out whether or not some of these cases should be brought in the first place.
Mm. I mean, Angela, for those cases where the decision is made to prosecute and somebody's remanded perhaps to custody, to prison, or then receives a prison sentence, what is prison like for people with these kinds of conditions? Is it an accommodating environment for them? Presumably not.
Well, I mean, my opinion of prison is I don't think it's an accommodating environment for anyone. I don't think our prison system allows rehabilitation as we want it. And I think this is where we have to look at what is the sentence for? What do we want from prison? Because prison is a horrible environment for everyone. But with a neurodivergent condition, the sensory overload of smells, sounds, of the cramped conditions, of the lighting in there, all these things can just make it even harder.
Can you describe what the lighting is like and the sound?
Just that kind of like a fluorescent, horrible clinical lighting that's very bright, that's in your eyes. Then the sound of prison, especially these big old Victorians, just the echoes up and down the landings. There is never a moment of silence. So for someone with a neurodivergent condition, if I struggle to concentrate on our conversation as it is, if I struggle to manage my emotions as it is, when I'm having to deal with this like bombardment of noise, of sound, I mentioned the smell as well, that can be a real sensory overload thing. So that can all just make it a lot worse, a lot harder to deal with your neurodivergent condition. And this is where I go back to what sentencing for in the first place, because you can't imprison someone for a certain amount of time and their neurological condition will go away. If we can provide psychoeducation, if we can help people understand their own brains and we can help people manage their own brains better during that sentence, then we're doing something right. But otherwise, prison's just going to be a really horrible experience for someone with one of these conditions, and they will leave at the end with no better understanding of their own brain, with no better understanding of the accepted and agreed upon ways that we should interact with other people in society. They'll have no better coping strategies than using drugs or alcohol or whatever it is that individual does. And if someone leaves prison like that, they will end up going back because they won't have learned anything about themselves in that time.
Robert, do you think prisons have improved for people with neurodivergent conditions since you commissioned that review?
Look, I think there has been a slight improvement in the sense that we've now got a go-to person in our prisons who has responsibility for neurodiversity. The next step is making sure that that understanding and learning is rolled out amongst prison officers. And I think there is a lot of interest to understand and get neurodiversity because it's another means of helping what they do with regard to jailcraft. It's the skill that so many prison officers learn and acquire to de-escalate situations that otherwise will spill into disorder or something even worse. The work that I've seen in the neurodiverse wings in places like Park Prison in Bridgend and Pentonville in London is a real beacon, I think, of how to do it and how, through informed engagement, people who otherwise have trigger points that lead to behaviour that, you know, they themselves would be ashamed of, are avoided. Whilst, you know, there has to be an investment in it to make sure that the wings work, ultimately, resources and time are being saved because neurodivergent prisoners, autistic prisoners, are just in a much better place. And that also means for them that if they're in a better place and the adrenaline levels are being managed and they're able to focus, they're going to be able to access courses and other means of help that will break the cycle of offending.
But how are they actually different, Robert, those wings that you're talking about?
What is different is you might see a little less busyness. You might see a little less, sensory overload, as Angela so brilliantly described. And you'll see more officers who've had the training. And those officers will often have built a relationship with particular individuals who might have been virtually impossible to handle. You know, we're talking about grown men here who would be on 23-hour lockdown because they would be just impossible to handle. And now engaging, sitting in a room with the prison officer, talking to them. You know, and I, as Lord Chancellor, went to see a few of them in Park Prison. I'd been given a list of things not to say and things to talk about. And that worked brilliantly. And I was able to talk about what the prisoner wanted to lead on in a way that meant that I was able to have a meaningful conversation with that person who perhaps a year before wouldn't have been brought near me because of the fear of violence or behaviour that would have been, you know, quite intimidating or triggered a heavy-handed response from the prison officers. So it can be done, but it is, I think, painstaking. And that's why my concern is that overworked prison officers who have a lot to do just will not have the time that you just need in order to make those engagements better.
Mm. I mean, Angela, it's obviously encouraging to hear that there's more identification of people with neurodivergent conditions and some steps being taken. But if the statistics are right and maybe half or more of people in prison have these kind of conditions, wouldn't it be better to just kind of try and make all prisons and all prison services, if you like, neurodivergent friendly rather than carving out particular spaces, particular services for a few?
Yeah, I mean, I think there has been huge leaps and bounds from, you know, a decade ago when neurodivergent conditions wasn't even mentioned, wasn't even discussed. So the fact that Pentonville Prison is trying to run a neuroinclusive, neurodiverse wing is incredible. And I think we should kind of give real credit there. Do I think that if we had better environmental design, everyone in prison would be calmer and everything would be a little easier? Yeah, I think the old Victorian prisons are just not fit for purpose. And you can do your best of making a neurodivergent informed unit in an old Victorian, but it will always be an old Victorian. It will always have that loud noises and echoes. The new builds are better designed. I think there has been a nod towards the importance of environmental design for encouraging better behaviour. And I think that's good for everyone. I don't think you'll ever do a disservice to someone who is neurotypical by making a prison design more neuro-inclusive. But I just wanted to make a really quick point about the officers being trained. I anecdotally think there is probably a high proportion of these people, the prison officers, the mental health nurses, the social workers, who also are neurodivergent. You don't want an office job. You want a job that is high adrenaline, a job that you're on your feet, moving your body. And I think there are situations where, were the staff to have a better understanding of their own neurodivergence, there would be an even better relationship between staff and prisoners. And I think supporting staff, if they have neurodivergent conditions, is also another kind of piece of that puzzle as well.
That makes sense, absolutely. Robert, I mean, talking about training, the review that was done by the Inspectorate and the user voice reports all call for this better training. But if you include all police officers, many of whom are very, very new on the job, all court staff, all lawyers, all prison staff, is it in any way realistic?
Well, I think we need to be ambitious, frankly. I think you're right to talk about new police officers, new prison officers as well. Young and inexperienced prison officers is an issue. But I think we've got to do something. You know, I could sit here and wring my hands and say, oh, it's not criminal justice's problem. It should be done further down the line. But it's not happening nearly enough. And until we get that point where youngsters are being properly screened in early years, then we're still going to be left with this game of catch-up. And that's why I think there's no alternative for us to learn more about these conditions. I mean, we've done it on mental health. I mean, the awareness and the acceptance of mental health issues as a factor that will apply in many cases is a given. And why shouldn't that be the case for neurodiversity?
Mm. I mean, you just as you have done now, you championed this issue very strongly when you were part of the government. Are you concerned that perhaps without a champion in the administration, the initiative may kind of fall by the wayside? Are you confident that it'll be taken forward?
Well, look, I'm really encouraged by what I saw after I left office. We've had a series of very, very good prison ministers. I've spoken to Ed Argar. He's now the Prisons and Probation Minister. He's just as committed to it as I was. So we've got that continuity now. So I feel that we've got a level of commitment that I think is encouraging. But I will continue now chairing, as I do, the all-party group on autism and the all-party group on learning disability to carry on, you know, making the case loudly and clearly that we need to continue moving the dial on neurodiversity. Otherwise, the cost in terms of lives and resource will just continue to go up and up.
Robert, looking at the kind of wider movements in the criminal justice system and how they impact on neurodivergent people, there's been, as you know, some recent legislation which has increased criminal sentences. And one example is an increase in the maximum sentence for assaulting a health worker or a police officer. Now, our own research suggests that neurodivergent people are disproportionately accused of this crime. So I don't know how you react to the fact that changes in legislation like this might actually lead to neurodivergent people getting increased sentences versus before.
Well, look, I was indeed in government when we made that decision. It wasn't one that I took lightly. I think we had to genuinely reflect the huge public concern there is about assaults on emergency workers who are our front line. But I do note that it has led to quite an increase in contested cases as well. A lot of these cases are going up to the Crown Court, and there's quite a lot of not guilty verdicts as well being recorded.
And lawyers told us, defence lawyers, that they thought the majority of their clients accused of this crime either were in mental health crisis or neurodivergent.
Yeah, well, this is interesting. And therefore, I think what we should be doing is looking again at the number of cases that are going through and the number of acquittals too, to see whether or not, in fact, you know, the tests are being applied in as realistic a way as possible. I understand morale in the police and in our emergency services does get hit when individuals have been quite seriously assaulted and nothing seems to be done. I absolutely accept that. But at the same time, frankly, we don't want a slew of cases that are resulting in
conditional discharge, maybe.
Well, indeed, or not guilty as well, that are taking up a lot of court time, bearing in mind the backlogs that we currently have. So I think that there would be a very good case to see what the trends are and what the proportions are. At the same time, I mean, I don't want policemen and paramedics to feel that they're being abandoned, but we do, I think, need to get a better understanding of, you know, the unintended consequences here for the whole system.
Mm. Angela, would you agree with that? How do you think the kind of calls for tougher justice to some extent, which we've heard in recent times will affect or are affecting neurodivergent people.
I think with the example you've given, I think that kind of offence is a really clear example of when people with neurodivergent conditions probably will get charged more than a neurotypical person. This is not in any way victim blaming at all, but I think it goes to show what we were talking about staff having to be trained and being able to de-escalate situations and being able to deal with people whose brains are slightly different to try and de-escalate these situations where upon arrest or in a hospital, someone is responding with violence. And I think we have to be very, very cautious here that there are victims who have been hurt by people. Having ADHD, having autism is not an excuse for punching someone in the face ever. And justice needs to be seen to be done. However, there are ways of de-escalating violent situations. And I've seen officers who can do it incredibly well. And those who haven't had the training or haven't had the years on the landings to learn that if I speak in that tone of voice, if I say that thing, if I do this thing, it will make the situation worse. And that's why we need all frontline staff trained and aware of neurodivergent conditions.
Well, thanks for that. I mean, perhaps that's a good note to end our fascinating discussion on. We end these podcasts by asking each of our contributors if they could make one change to the system, what they would do. So in this case, what one thing, Robert, would you do to improve the criminal justice system for neurodivergent people?
Well, I would do something that ostensibly isn't actually related to the criminal justice system at all, and that is train health service workers to screen for neurodivergent conditions at an early age so that we actually get the proper diagnoses as early as possible, and then we can put in mitigating measures to support people rather than preside over their spiral into the baleful consequences of ending up in the criminal justice system itself.
Thank you. What about you, Angela?
I'm also going to go a bit left field here. I think we really need to look at drug and alcohol addiction as a health issue. I think particularly for people with ADHD, the use of substances, the use of drugs and alcohol that then becomes problematic, that then leads to prison, that then leads to more and more crimes in our society. If we treated it as a health condition, if people were given support to truly rehabilitate rather than criminalised for their activity around that, I think we would see a huge reduction in crime and a huge reduction in the prison population too.
Rob, what about you? If you were Prime Minister and you could make one change in this arena, what would you do?
Well, I'm actually going to go for a narrower change. There are, to my mind, welcome plans to suspend prison sentences for those given short prison sentences. They're in legislation going through Parliament. This means the probation service will be dealing with some more cases and some more tricky cases, and those will include some neurodiverse people. We haven't mentioned the need for probation services and others working with offenders in the community to have the kind of training, the awareness, the screening and so on. So I think that needs to be introduced, and we mustn't miss the boat on that.
Thanks, Rob, Robert and Angela. Information about reports we've mentioned will be in our programme notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, do spread the word. Thanks to all our guests. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful.